It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, and welcome to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm your host this evening, Nicholas Goroff, filling in for Steve Taylor. Tonight's story is a haunting meditation on grief, memory, and the quiet ways love can linger long after loss. When a grieving woman finds comfort in two small carvings of the husband and son she lost in a fire, those smiling, black-eyed figures began to feel like more than keepsakes. And as the fragile piece of her new life begins to splinter, she may discover some promises never survive death. Settle in and dim the lights. The show is about to begin. Before we get to tonight's feature, however, we'd like to thank our dedicated supporters in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights patrons area. For just $7.99 a month, members receive ad-free listening, early access to new episodes, exclusive content, and our complete archive, with discounted annual options available as well. That means instant access to a massive audio archive of Nightmare Fuel spanning more than a decade, with episodes and releases going all the way back to 2012. To learn more or become a member, visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com. Thank you for helping us keep the darkness alive, month after month. Featured tonight, courtesy of Velox Books, tonight's tale is written by Ryan Major, performed by Katie Otten and yours truly, Nicholas Goroff, with production by Drew Blood. For more from Ryan Major, be sure to check out his latest collection, I've Done This Before, 20 Tales of Horror and the Supernatural, now available on Amazon.com in hardcover, paperback, audiobook, and Kindle ebook formats. Praised by Travis Brown, author of How to Build a Haunted House, as writing that will transport you to wonderful and terrifying places. The collection gathers 20 uncanny tales steeped in dread, deja vu, and the supernatural. And now, without further delay, I present to you, from author Ryan Major, Never Really Gone.
I think I'm going to get the job as principal next year, I said to my husband as I ate dinner. He sat quietly as usual, unblinking and attentive. The interview isn't until next week, but Superintendent Rance keeps talking to me about when I'm in charge, so that seems promising. My husband, Walter, stares at me with a lopsided smile, and I return the grin. Our son, Aaron, sits across the table from him with his usual mischievous grin. Dinner with them is the best part of my day, and I hope they know that. No one makes me feel more special than they do. I'm not sure I'm ready, though, I continued. Both gazed at me with anticipation as I continued to discuss my future. Being a vice principal is already a lot of pressure, but running an entire school just seems like a whole new world of stress. The pay raise would be great, though. The budget is getting kind of thin since I bought the new house. My husband and son just continued to smile at me as I ate the rest of my dinner in silence. Their coal black faces gleam cheerily at me as I collect my dirty dishes and carry them from the table to the sink. From their perch on the kitchen table, I can see the small soapstone carvings of my husband and son. It was sad, but still it was comforting. Walter and Aaron died 3 years ago when our old house caught fire. While I was away in Orlando for an educators' conference, the electrical outlet in our kitchen downstairs had set the house ablaze and trapped them in the upstairs bedrooms. The fire investigator had tried to tell me what had happened, but I fell to pieces as he tried to explain how Walter had tried to save Aaron. I just couldn't listen. Those two hung the stars in the sky for me. When they died, I lost everything in the world that I loved most. Our entire life is filled with grief of one variety or another. But in one fell swoop, an entire lifetime of grief fell in my lap. It almost broke me, too. But then I found the statues. Friends and family were kind enough to try and salvage what little bit could be found in the charred carcass that was our home. After the top floor was demolished, to make the remains safe to enter, they went to work searching for keepsakes and salvageable pieces of our lives together. By the end of the effort, there was less than a shoebox full of memories. I'm eternally grateful for the people who sifted through the ashes of my life, and for the few precious things they found. More than anything, I'm grateful for the statues. Walter owned a company digging water wells across the country. He spent countless evenings trying to tell me about his work, but I was so often preoccupied that I don't recall many details. I did my best to listen to him, but thoughts of upcoming staff training or forgotten tasks always haunted my mind when he discussed work. Man, if I could turn back time to hear just one more story about a Texas ranch water well, I would hang on to every word. What I do remember clearly was the numerous amount of trips Walt would take overseas to dig wells in developing countries. I always teased him that it was a tax write-off to see foreign lands, and he would laugh it off. Walt was kind-hearted. We lived an exceptionally fortunate life, and it was important to him to give to those who hadn't lived the kind of life we were afforded. 3 years ago, Walt traveled to Niamey, Niger. It was an African country I didn't know very much about, but Walt was over the moon about the trip. For all of the work-life discussions that I drifted out on, hearing him talk about traveling for relief work always kept my attention. Aaron hung on to every word, too. He idolized his father. Rightfully so. Walt was one in a million, and Aaron was too. I was so lucky to have had them. Walt was gone for 3 weeks. Aaron, 7 years old and crestfallen that his hero traveled overseas without him, stayed home with me. We talked daily about what we thought his father was doing and all the amazing things he had seen. Evening text messages kept us up to date on his location and sent messages of love. We missed Walt, but as any mother with a son knows, time with a little boy is precious. You have to take in those innocent years before they grow into serious men. Each night before bed, Aaron would pull a piece of paper out of his pocket and read it intently. He would wander the house as he glanced down at the folded note and nod occasionally. Once he had made a full trip around the house, he would sit next to me in the living room and slide the note back into his pocket. "What's that, buddy?" I asked him. "It's a list Dad gave me before he left," he said with a serious look on his face. "He said I had to do everything on the list every night to help you." "May I see it?" I asked with a chuckle. "It must be very important." Aaron smiled and handed me the list. I unfolded it and started reading. "Dear Stinker, I'm going to need you to take care of some things while I'm gone. Please follow all of the steps each night before bed until I get back. I'm counting on you. Check all of the doors and be sure they are locked. Turn off the lights in empty rooms. Make sure the dog has plenty of food and water. Keep Mom safe. She gets scared when I'm gone, so be brave. I love you, buddy. Sneak a cookie when Mom isn't looking. She'll catch you anyway, but I bet she'll let you finish it. See you soon, Love, Dad. When Walter returned from Africa, he told Aaron and me all of the amazing places he had been and all the wonderful people he met. All through his stories, I could see Aaron's eyes transfixed on the duffel bag by my father's feet. He knew there were gifts inside and did his best to listen patiently. After Walter finished telling us about his trip, he kneeled on one knee and unzipped the tattered duffel bag. Fishing around inside, he brought out a colorful beaded necklace and handed it to Aaron. His eyes sparkled with a fascination for the trinket his father had brought back from overseas. With a quick thank you, Aaron darted to his room to add it to his collection of items his father had brought back from his travels. "And for you," Walter said as he pulled a box from the bag. "I have something handmade and one of a kind." Walter placed the box on the counter and gestured for me to open it. Sliding the lid off and pulling away pieces of crumpled pieces of newspaper, I could see three stone figures nestled in the bottom of the container. A man, a woman, and a little boy, cut from blue-gray stone and polished to a high gleam. I marveled at how much they look like us, our family. "One translator showed us a stone carver when I asked about a custom gift for you," Walter said as he brushed a scrap of paper away from the figure of our son. "The craftsman said that the carvings will watch over our family when any of us are away and keep them safe. Seemed like the kind of thing you would enjoy." I stayed in bed the majority of the time for the first 6 months after Walter and Aaron died. Initially, I lived with my sister and brother-in-law. They did their best to help me through the grief, but they rarely left me alone. No doubt my attempts to withdraw alarmed them, but grieving with an audience was difficult. The homeowner's insurance policy allowed me to purchase a modest home in the suburbs outside of town. My sister begged me to stay with them longer, but I declined. The healthier thing to do would have been to stay with them longer, but I needed space. Boxes of unassembled furniture, home decor, and kitchen necessities filled the new house for months. Family and friends had been kind enough to take me shopping for new things, but once they arrived, I could never muster the willpower to begin putting the pieces of my life together. My old life had been so well built. Our future was certain. We were blessed. No one prepares you to lose everything and be left behind to start from scratch. At the 6-month mark, some unusual things started happening. The box of mementos from the house fire had been sitting on the kitchen counter since I moved into the new house. While I had already looked through the assorted photos and knickknacks that had been collected, I hadn't unpacked them. I had just gotten out of bed and headed into the kitchen to fix a cup of coffee when I saw that the lid of the box was sitting to the side. As I walked closer, I could see that some of the contents had been shuffled around. I was puzzled, but assumed that I must have looked through it recently and forgotten to close it. Lifting the lid to put it back in place, I was startled by the two obsidian figures sitting on the counter. Black eyes gazed at me from beneath the lid. The lopsided smile and mischievous grin I was so familiar with sent a cold chill running up my spine. The soapstone statues of my husband and son sat on the counter, oriented in my direction, as if they had been waiting for me. My mind raced. I had no memory of opening the box or looking through the contents. There was little chance I had taken the statues out and placed them on the counter. My new house had a security system that I armed each evening, so the odds of an intruder rummaging through my things were equally as unlikely. Palming my cell phone, I considered calling my sister and brother-in-law to ask if they had been to the house recently without my knowledge. My thumb was scrolling through my contacts when I decided against it. The two of them had spent such a great deal of time worrying over me that I didn't want to give them any additional cause for concern over my mental state. Scooping the two stone sculptures up, I prepared to place them back into the box when my eyes met those belonging to the statue of Aaron. Even made of stone, the eyes still sparkled with wonder and amazement. The mischievous smirk made me smile, even as the tears of despair filled the corner of my eyes. I knew at that moment that I couldn't place them back in the box. Hiding them there would no more heal my spirits than the months of dwelling in my darkened bedroom had. While my heart ached as I looked at the two stone carvings, I also began to feel a sense of happiness, almost as if I had them back in some small way. From that moment, things began to improve slowly but surely. Boxes that had gathered dust for months were opened. IKEA furniture was assembled and put in place. My husband and son sat atop the kitchen counter, where they had a view into the open dining room and living room. Their intricately carved eyes kept a watch as my new home slowly came together. I even found myself beginning to talk to them. When I completed a piece of furniture, I would ask the carving of my husband where he thought I should place it. A small voice in my head that sounded so much like his would give me an opinion. More often than not, I adhered to the imaginary answer. Walter always had a good sense of how to put a room together. After a lot of internal struggle, I decided to end my bereavement leave from school. Returning to work lifted my spirits as well. The students and faculty were extremely kind and welcomed me back warmly. My grief wasn't gone, but the weight was becoming manageable. When I returned home from school, the carvings of my husband and son were always waiting for me on the kitchen counter. It didn't seem to matter whether I entered the kitchen from the garage door or through the living room from the front door. Walter and Aaron always seemed to be facing the door I walked through, as if to greet me. Exactly when I started eating dinner with them on the table, I can't be sure. I spoke to the statues daily about my experiences and feelings. In my mind, I knew they were only sculptures of my family, but treating them as if they were my son and husband comforted me. There is no doubt in my mind this wasn't a healthy coping mechanism, but it got me through my days with a greater deal of ease. A year after their deaths, and I was functioning on an almost normal level again. Where initially my every waking moment was filled with thoughts of them, I was now able to focus on required tasks again. Walter and Aaron always crept back in, but their memories were a source of joy and motivation, rather than an anchor dragging me farther under. And I always knew the end of my day would result in a quiet dinner with their effigies. It was also around this time when unusual things began to happen more frequently with the statues. Nothing overtly terrifying, but unsettling nonetheless. One morning, I misplaced my car keys. School started in less than half an hour, and I was dangerously close to being late. Usually, I left them sitting on the kitchen counter, but this morning, they were nowhere to be found. After more than 10 minutes of frantically searching for my keys, I was startled by a loud noise in the kitchen. It sounded like a bowling ball had fallen onto the tile. Heavy clacking like the sound of stone on stone echoed down the hallway, followed by the jingling of metal. Rushing into the kitchen to see what happened, I saw the statue of my husband sitting in the center of the kitchen floor. Next to it were my car keys. I had walked through the kitchen at least a dozen times during my frantic search for them, but there they sat. Scooping the keys from the floor and placing the statue of my husband back on the counter, my mind raced. As I looked toward Walter's statue, I was transfixed by the lopsided smile. It almost seemed to say, "You've got to keep up with your keys, Emily. What would you do without me? All the doors were locked. No one could have come inside. Even if they had, what burglar would locate your car keys and move a keepsake into the center of the floor? It consumed my mind for the entire workday. Were the statues moving? Was I losing my mind? The thought terrified me. Since their removal from the box, the statues of my family had either been on the kitchen counter or the dining room table when I ate dinner. While I would occasionally move them to clean the kitchen surfaces, they kept their watch from there. Over time, though, they could more frequently be found in different places. One evening, I was awoken by the sound of the squealing of door hinges. A habit from college, when I had too many roommates, I had always slept with my door closed. When my eyes focused in the dark, I could see that the door was only ajar, maybe 5 or 6 inches. The light from the security system panel blinked green in the darkness of the room, showing that the exterior door alarm was still armed. I moved my arm to the nightstand to turn on the lamp when my forearm unexpectedly bumped into something hard. It fell over onto the wooden surface of the table, and the noise made me jump. Bolting up in bed, I reached again for the lamp and turned it on. The statue of Walter lay on its side, smiling and gazing at me. Aaron sat just behind him, smiling as well. As I walked to the kitchen holding the 2 stone effigies, my mind retraced my steps before I had gone to bed. I ate in the dining room with the statues, took them to the kitchen while I washed dishes, and went to brush my teeth. There was no memory of having brought them to the bedroom. The thought had crossed my mind thousands of times to leave them there to watch over me as I slept, but I had drawn the line there. I spent so much time talking to the inanimate objects that I knew there had to be a limit somewhere. Still, I must have moved them into the bedroom with me. Perhaps I had spent so much time talking to them throughout the day that I was inadvertently picking them up and placing them in different places throughout the house. A cold chill still rattled my bones as I placed them back on the countertop. They smiled at me as always, but now those smiles filled me with fear and discomfort. 2 years after the house fire, and I had agreed to go on my first date. It was a strange sensation on so many levels. Life doesn't do much to equip you for the thought of re-entering the dating pool when you're nearly 40 years old. It was something I hadn't done intentionally. A few gentlemen here and there had expressed interest, but I had politely declined. Dennis was unexpected. A colleague from my first years of teaching, Dennis had moved to another school in the district nearly 8 years ago. Our classrooms had been next door to each other for my first 3 years on the job, and we both taught freshman English. He was handsome and witty. We reconnected at a district-wide meeting the year before. During one of those annoyingly childish group exercises, I was shocked to see him smiling at me from across the table. His dark hair had gone to salt and pepper, but that rogue smile of his was the same as it ever was. We finished the meeting and he caught up with me outside.
"Emily!"
he shouted from behind me. He smiled widely.
"Hey! Good to see you. How've you been?"
"I've been better," I said with a forced smile. "Things are getting better, I guess."
"Oh, damn,"
Dennis replied, smile melting away to a look of shame.
"Walter and Aaron, I'm so sorry. I meant to call, but it always felt like a bad time."
I raised a hand to his shoulder and gave him my best attempt at a comforting squeeze. "Life gets hard sometimes," I replied. "As I said, it's getting better. Slowly. How are you and Samantha?" Dennis' eyes dropped to the ground, and he ran a hand through his shaggy hair.
"Yeah, Sam and I split up a few years back,"
he muttered.
"Seems like I wasn't the only one for her anymore."
"Damn myself," I replied sympathetically. We know how to start a conversation with an old friend, don't we? He laughed. I smiled. Everything happened quickly from there. We went for coffee that day, and it seems like we were rarely apart from one another unless we were at work. Dennis cooked dinner with me almost every night. Bottles of wine vanished rapidly. I was intimate for the first time since my husband passed away. For the first 2 months, the statues of Walter and Aaron sat silently. They watched our meals and listened to our conversations. Dennis had asked me about them, and I had told him they were some of my few mementos of life before the fire. What I failed to tell him is how the statues had been companions to me almost every night since my family had died. I grew increasingly uneasy with them watching me live my life without them. Dennis would happily talk about his day at work and the various events he had scheduled in the coming months. Nodding along agreeably, my eyes would lock with the statues. They continued their whimsical smiles, but my sense of guilt continued as well. Dennis never noticed when I moved the statues to the small table in the entryway of my house. I couldn't bear to have them watch me fall in love with another man. They weren't my dead husband and son. I knew that. It still felt wrong, almost voyeuristic. While the first 5 months of my romance with Dennis had swept me off my feet, warts began to show themselves soon after. The turn was sudden and unexpected. Dennis had become such a source of comfort and warmth for me. It was jarring to see how quickly he changed. Where he had once been talkative and attentive, he had grown quieter and reserved in the evenings. Dennis had started to rearrange things in my house without asking me. When I asked him why, he would look at me with contempt and explain condescendingly how much better it looked. There were also offhanded comments about my appearance. I didn't wear makeup or dress to impress him every day, but my appearance was always tidy. He never said I was ugly, but a point was made often that I could do more to look pretty for him. On at least 2 occasions, I'm certain he was trying to go through my cell phone. I kept it password locked. As a school teacher, you learn hard lessons about leaving an unlocked cell phone on your desk. A few times when I tried to unlock the phone, a warning appeared on the screen that it was locked for a certain period of time before I could try my password again. The phone was set to allow for 10 attempts before the timeout went into effect. When I asked Dennis about it, he looked at me as though I had accused him of murder. We didn't talk for a few days after the second conversation, but it blew over eventually. We stopped cooking dinner together, and he began to question me when food wasn't ready when he came to visit after work. I initially teased him about it and joked that he could come to give me a hand.
Samantha always had dinner ready when I got home from work,
he said dismissively as he read a newspaper at the kitchen table. I was standing at the stove stirring ground beef in a skillet for tacos. Turning my head toward him, I stared in disbelief. Walter would have offered to help, I quipped in return before returning my attention to the skillet.
Well,
he said briskly.
It really is too bad he burned in the house instead of burning dinner like you frequently do.
I dropped the spatula onto the stove and turned to face him. His face was as solemn as a gargoyle, and his eyes were piercing. He smiled cruelly in my direction and began to read the paper again. Get the hell out of my house, I said in a shockingly calm tone. Dennis continued reading the newspaper. Did you hear me? I asked. He didn't look up.
I'm sorry,
he replied without much emotion.
That was unkind. It's been a long day and I'm hungry. Can I help you finish cooking?
He dropped his newspaper to the counter and began to walk toward the stove. I lifted my hand to his chest and held it firmly to stop him from continuing forward. He looked at me in astonishment and brushed my hand aside. I said, "Get the hell out of my house!" I shouted. Do you not understand what I'm telling you? Then his surprised look turned to one of shame and disappointment. He continued to the stove and picked up the spatula. Stirring the meat quietly, he still didn't respond. "Leave now," I spat and jerked the spatula from his hand. "You will not talk about my husband that way. You won't have the chance. This is through. We're done. Leave." Red rage filled his cheeks, and he began to peer down at the sizzling pan of ground beef. His hands clenched into fists that began to turn a pale white. The corners of his mouth began to twitch as he turned toward me. His face looked rigid and cruel. Without warning, his hand shot out and grabbed my wrist forcefully.
"I said I was sorry,"
he said through gritted teeth. His grip on my wrist was getting tighter, and I could feel the loss of blood in my hand. I drew my free hand back to strike him, but he caught the blow before it landed.
"Samantha even knew when to accept my..."
The sound of breaking glass and the blast of a car alarm exploded in the kitchen. We both turned our heads toward the window to the front of the house, where flashing headlights and turn signals now erupted. Loud wails from the car horn filled our ears. Dennis released his painful grip on my wrist and darted for the front door. I followed behind him and watched as he approached his car in the driveway. Shards of glass were scattered across the hood and onto the concrete. His windshield was shattered, and one of the planters from my porch sat clumsily on his dashboard.
"Emily, call the cops,"
he said as he looked over the damage.
"My phone is on the kitchen counter."
I walked back to the kitchen and picked up his phone. Walking back to the front door, I was still in shock at how he had just treated me. Looking at him standing in my driveway caused my rage to overflow. I threw his cell phone out the door and into the front yard. He watched it sail from my hand and bounce into the grass. Darting toward the phone, he looked at me in disgust. "Call them yourself," I said flatly. "Once the cops finish their report, leave. Don't come back." I watched from the porch as he dialed the number for the police and asked for a unit to come to my house. He paced in the front yard, looking from end to end in case the vandal was still in the vicinity. Looking down where the planter had been, I saw something that I couldn't quite make out in the dark of the evening. Squatting down, I picked up the smooth object and held it up in the path of the streetlight. A mischievous grin and sparkling eyes full of wonder met mine. The statue of Aaron reflected the abrasive light from overhead. I clutched him to my chest. Tears flowed down my cheeks as I headed back into the house. Locking the doors behind me, I scooped the statue of Walter off of the foyer table and carried it to my bedroom. Gently, I placed both carvings on my nightstand and crawled beneath the blankets. After an hour, I got out of bed and looked through the dining room window to see that Dennis and his car were gone. The driveway was still covered in broken shards of glass and the discarded planter. I would clean that up tomorrow. For now, I was just relieved that he was gone. I crawled back into bed and looked at the statues on the nightstand. The tears had stopped, but I felt worse than I had in months. At least I had them. "I love you both so much," I said quietly as I closed my eyes. A voice in the back of my mind seemed to say, "We love you too." Things were calm for around a month after I kicked Dennis out of the house. Phone calls and text messages bombarded me throughout the day and night. I couldn't make it through an entire day of school without hearing my phone vibrate in a drawer at least a dozen times. The voicemails and texts all implored me to call him back. I just needed to hear him out. He could explain if only I would give him a chance. That single bad night didn't represent who he was. I would have been content to never answer his calls or texts for the rest of my days. That had been my goal. It was easy enough to manage for a while, but eventually his persistence and deception caught me off guard. As I sat on my bed beside the carvings of my family reading a book, my phone began to buzz beside me. When I picked it up, I recognized the number. It belonged to the central office of the Board of Education. It was after hours, and I was confused, but hit the green button to accept the call anyway. "Hello, this is Emily Clark," I said in a slightly confused but pleasant tone of voice. "Kind of late to be working, isn't it?"
"Why won't you answer my calls, Emily?"
a rough voice said.
"I just want to explain myself, but you won't give me the chance."
"Dennis?" I asked.
"Yes,"
he replied.
"You're a hard woman to get a hold of. Look, I just want to explain what happened that night and clear the air."
His voice was different than usual. His tongue sounded heavy and his words slurred. "I don't want to talk to you," I said. "Please stop calling me."
"Please,"
he responded. I could hear him crying.
"Just let me explain myself. Can I come over?"
"No," I said angrily. "You've been drinking. Why are you in the board office?" I could hear three loud whacks from what I could only assume was Dennis slamming the receiver of the phone on a desk.
"I took a key from the school before I left work,"
he said loudly after the banging had ceased.
"It was the only way I thought I could get you to answer your damn phone."
"Goodbye, Dennis," I said sternly. "Don't come to my house and don't call me again." I was about to end the call when I heard him scream.
"I tried to do it the nice way. When I get to your house, I'll kick your door in and..."
I hung the phone up and immediately called 911. Veins throbbed in the side of my head and my heart thundered in my chest. After two brief rings, someone spoke on the other end.
911, what is your emergency?
Dennis was arrested as he drove to my house. The emergency dispatcher sent out the description of his car and the potential travel routes that I provided. Officers made contact with him three blocks from my house. They found a handgun in the passenger seat of his car. In addition to his charges of terroristic threatening and DUI, the Board of Education also pressed charges against him for breaking into the board building. He was terminated immediately and held in county jail. I nervously checked the county detention center website multiple times per day to make sure he hadn't been released. It surprised me that he hadn't bailed himself out, but day after day he remained there. The mystery of his failure to make bail was solved when Dennis's ex-wife, Samantha, called 2 weeks after the drunken phone call. Through tears, she told me of her abusive marriage. Dennis had never hit her, but the mental and emotional abuse was immense. She apologized for not reaching out to me sooner to warn me, but I assured her no apology was necessary. Samantha confided in me that Dennis had a gambling addiction and lived in crippling debt. She had endured years of emotional abuse, but it was the near-poverty state they were living in that finally prompted her to take the children and leave. He was 6 months behind on child support, and the court system had started to garnish his wages. A sliver of me felt sorry for him. I also felt a little bit of shame that I knew wasn't fair. His financial situation wouldn't allow him to afford bail or an attorney. None of it was my fault, but some black tendril of emotional manipulation tried to anchor itself in my brain. Those kinds of thoughts can grow like cancer. Mental and physical abuse can cause even the strongest person to become numb and hollow. Samantha had survived her ordeal and managed to escape. I was proud of her, though I never told her. While I may not have allowed it to continue, so many people are manipulated into accepting it, or worse, believing they deserve it. With the assistance of a local domestic violence advocacy group, I was able to receive a protective order against Dennis. A kind advocate walked me through the process and assisted me with the court filing. The process was uncomfortable, as our state allows both parties to be present in court to present evidence. But this amazing group was with me every step of the way. Life returned to the shattered version of normalcy that I had achieved before Dennis entered the picture. The events caused me to withdraw again, but my sister and brother-in-law were a constant source of comfort. They stayed with me for a few weeks. My brother-in-law even slept in a chair beside the front door for the first few nights. A bit overzealous, perhaps, but amazing nonetheless. After a few weeks, I grew more comfortable, and they returned home. It was lonely, but also nice to have a bit of space to myself. My sister, ever the worrier, insisted on leaving a handgun for me. I tucked it away in my nightstand, hoping never to use it. Honestly, I didn't even feel completely alone. The obsidian carvings of my husband and son kept watch over me day and night. I moved them from room to room with me throughout the day when I was home. The carvings soothed me, but also concerned me. I could never fully come to terms with some of the strange events surrounding them. The car keys, showing up on the nightstand, Dennis' broken car window. Mentally, I knew they weren't moving, but I could not remember moving them on some occasions. I returned to work 3 weeks after the night Dennis was arrested. The support of the faculty and students humbled me again. Never let anyone tell you that community isn't important. Kindness and comfort received from them were invaluable to me. I finally stopped checking the detention center website religiously. Dinner time had returned to the unusual format as before. Each evening when I returned home, I would cook myself a meal and move the statues to the dinner table to keep me company. I would share the events of the day, and the two of them would smile politely as their carved eyes almost seemed to glitter with life as they reflected the overhead light. In the evenings, I would place them on my nightstand. I would say goodnight to them and tell them how much I loved and missed them. In the back of my mind, I would always hear them say it as well. It was unsettling, but comforting. It was 3:05, and I heard something move in my bedroom. My eyes burst open and struggled to adjust to the darkness. A sensation of being watched flooded my body, and the hairs on my arms stood on end. I felt like a gazelle barreling through the savannah, knowing all the while that lions perched in the high grass, waiting to pounce. I brushed my arm to the nightstand and felt shocked when I didn't make contact with the soapstone statues. In a panic, I turned and pulled the chain on my bedside lamp, and blinding illumination flooded the room. A figure stood in front of my bedroom door.
"Hello, Emily,"
Dennis said, his eyes cold and piercing. I broke loose from my frozen state and pulled the nightstand drawer out. Pulling too hard, the drawer fell out of place and slammed to the ground. The contents were dumped onto the floor and scattered across the carpet. Terrified, my eyes darted from side to side, trying to find the handgun my sister had left me. It was nowhere to be found. I looked at my nightstand, and my cell phone was gone as well. Somehow, I was most startled to see that the carvings of Walter and Aaron were missing.
"Looking for these?"
Dennis said with amusement. He dropped my cell phone to the floor and stomped it. The cracking of the screen made me cringe. After destroying the phone, he pulled up the tail bottom of his shirt to reveal the handle of the gun that once rested in my nightstand drawer.
"I figured you may have gotten the gun since I was last able to see you. Thank God you're a heavy sleeper, baby. You could have hurt me before we got to talk."
"The alarm," I muttered. The cops will be here soon."
"Cut the phone line,"
he said without pause.
"Should have spent the money on a better system. You can be so silly sometimes. That's why you need me."
Dennis began to step toward me slowly. Still wrapped in the blankets, I began to push myself backward. As I tried to slide my legs out from under the blankets and onto the floor, I became tangled and fell from the edge of the bed.
"Emily,"
he said with surprise.
"Are you okay? Let me help you up."
He walked around the corner of the bed and stared at me. I pushed myself into the corner in a panic reflex and stared at him, fear swelling. My eyes watered with rage and disgust. "Dennis," I whimpered, "please leave. I have a protective order. You'll go to jail."
"Sweetheart,"
he said as he stood over me.
"I just want to talk. I don't like how things ended, and I just want to try and make it right."
"No," I said more forcefully. Dennis smiled in amusement as he looked at me. My eyes were drawn to the outline of the gun under his shirt. I only had to wait for him to get a little closer to me, and I would make a move for it. He ran his hands through his messy hair and sighed.
"Look here,"
he said, almost exasperated.
"You got me thrown in jail, and I forgive you. We can work this out. You've just got to be smart about this. Are you going to throw this away over one bad night?"
"You hurt me, Dennis," I replied. "I'm not going to let you hurt me." The amused smile slid off of his face. A mask of pure rage replaced it. The look of malice and contempt from the night he grabbed me in the kitchen presented itself. No, this face wasn't a mask. This was the real Dennis. The mask was the kind and genial man who had wooed me over coffee. The man who melted away my defenses. That man was a lie. This hateful thing before me was Dennis.
"If you think that was me hurting you,"
he said in a low tone,
"then you are about to learn a difficult lesson."
As Dennis began to close the short distance and reach toward me, I prepared myself to fight back. Bracing my feet against the wall, I knew I would only have one shot to take the gun. Just one shot to make it out of this alive. 5 feet away, 4 feet away, 3 feet away, 2 feet away. This was it. As Dennis stood a foot away from me, there was a sound of stampeding footsteps in the hallways. Heavy thuds resounded and shook the room. The reverberation was so intense, I could feel it in my bones.
"Who the hell is here?"
Dennis said, head snapping toward the door to the hallway.
"Tell me who."
His sentence was cut off, and I pushed off against the wall and wrapped my arms around his waist. I pushed him backward with all my strength, and he began to stumble. Feet tangled, Dennis twisted his ankle and began to fall forward, smacking his head against the floor with a sickening thud. Before pushing myself off of the floor, I pulled the shirt away from the waistband of his pants and pulled the gun from his waist. Switching off the safety, I took a step back and aimed the gun at him as he lay sprawled on the carpet. It took him a moment to collect himself. By the time he did, he was looking into the barrel of the gun. The rage returned to his face for a moment, but fear danced in his hateful eyes. He held his hands up in a gesture of defeat. "Get up," I spat. "Keep your hands in the air and walk 5 feet in front of me. We're going to the neighbors to call the cops."
"And if I don't?"
he asked. "The first shot goes in your leg," I replied. "If that doesn't work, we'll move from there. Get moving." Dennis wobbly lifted himself back onto his feet and put his hands in the air. He limped clumsily toward the bedroom door. His pace was slow, and I made sure to keep a safe distance between us. The ankle may not be as bad as it seemed, and I wasn't taking any chances. Dennis passed through the bedroom door into the hallways, hands still raised. Without warning, the bedroom door slammed shut. His hands were visible above his head, and I knew that he couldn't possibly have moved that quickly.
"What the hell?"
I heard him say through the door. Rushing forward, I began to turn the knob, but the door wouldn't budge. No matter how hard I tried to turn it, the handle wouldn't rotate.
"Hey! Hey! Get off of me!"
Dennis began to shriek like a wounded animal. Thrashing and thuds penetrated the door. The floor shook, and the sound of something being dragged across the floor filled my ears. Dry cracks echoed in the hall, and Dennis' wails grew louder. It was the snapping of bones.
"No, please,"
he begged.
"I'm sorry. I'll never bother her again. Just don't..."
Silence. I backed away from the door and raised the gun toward it. There was no noise coming from the hallway now. Unnerving silence filled the space where the desperate screams had been only moments earlier. My heart jumped into my throat when I heard the click of the light from the other side of the door. Bars of illumination filtered in from the space beneath. The latch clicked, and the hinges squealed as the door slowly opened into the bedroom. Dennis was gone. Sitting in the center of the hallway were two small stone figures. Even from this distance, I could see the lopsided grin and mischievous smile that I loved and missed so much. Their eyes sparkled, almost alive. Underneath the base of the smaller effigy, there was a scrap of paper. Venturing carefully into the hallway, gun still leveled, I approached the carvings of my husband and son. I pulled a scrap of paper from below the carving of Aaron. The paper was yellow and crinkled with age, and the edges were blackened and flaking. Tears streamed down my cheek as I read the words, "Keep Mom safe."
You've just heard Never Really Gone, written by Ryan Major, performed by Katie Alton and yours truly, Nicholas Goroff, with production by Drew Blood. Our thanks once again to Velox Books for helping bring tonight's feature to our listeners. And if Ryan Major's brand of horror got its hooks into you tonight, don't stop here. His debut collection, I've Done This Before, 20 Tales of Horror and the Supernatural, is available now on Amazon.com in hardcover, paperback, audiobook, and Kindle ebook formats. Packed with eerie encounters, uncanny premises, and nightmare scenarios that blur the line between the familiar and the impossible, it's a strong next stop for anyone craving more smart, imaginative horror. And if you're in the mood for more dark delights after tonight's performance, there are dozens of entries from the first two rounds of this year's Evil Idol competition waiting for you, along with hundreds more from previous years of the contest, all gathered on our YouTube channel and sorted into convenient playlists for easy listening. There's no shortage of terror waiting for you. Why not dive in tonight? And if you haven't already, please consider following Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, leaving us a 5-star rating or review, and sharing the show with a fellow fan of the macabre. You can even find more terrifying tales at creepypastastories.com and stay up to date with Evil Idol 2025 and all our latest releases by subscribing to our YouTube channel. Memberships are available now at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where for just $7.99 per month, you'll get ad-free listening, early access, exclusive content, and access to our complete audio archive. With discounted annual options available, and a library of chills and thrills stretching all the way back to 2012. Follow us on Facebook, X, Instagram, and TikTok. And as always, thank you for spending part of your night with us. And now, fellow lover of the macabre, I am afraid our evening tonight draws to a close. You've been listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Until next time, I'm your host, Nicholas Goroff, filling in for Steve Taylor, reminding you to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listeners. Sweet dreams.